When it comes to American haunted houses, which one comes to mind? Many believe the most haunted home in America is the Myrtles, a grand antebellum plantation originally built around 1797 in what is now St. Francisville, Louisiana. Today, the Myrtles plantation claims a dozen ghosts, but who are these souls seemingly trapped there eternally? Is there any truth to one of the most famous ghosts, that of Chloe, an enslaved woman entangled in a web of desperation and tragedy, whose presence has been witnessed by many? What truths lurk behind her haunting tale, and what other secrets and mysteries lay behind those walls? Welcome to Nightmare Houses. David Bradford was born in 1759 in Cecil County, Maryland, amidst lingering British rule. His quick rise to prominence as a lawyer and later deputy attorney general in Washington County, Pennsylvania, exemplified his resilience and understanding. By 1785, Bradford wed Elizabeth Eliza Porter, marking the beginning of their bustling household. The Bradford family grew with the arrival of Abelard in 1787, Jane in 1789, Edmund in 1790, and Sophia in 1791. By 1792, Bradford's ambition extended beyond Pennsylvania as he applied for a land grant in Spanish-controlled Louisiana's burgeoning territories. His interest in this land foreshadowed a dramatic shift in his life and the legacy he would forever leave behind. But things took a turn in 1794, which brought personal and political turmoil. David Bradford became involved in the Whiskey Rebellion, a defiant stand against the federal excise tax on whiskey. His involvement and leadership in this rebellion earned him the nickname Whiskey Dave and made him a target of the federal authorities. In the aftermath of this rebellion, Bradford fled to Spanish-controlled Louisiana, seeking refuge and embarking on a new, uncertain future. Upon his arrival at Bayou Sara, Louisiana in 1796, Bradford was greeted by land and promise. By 1797, he had secured a Spanish land grant of approximately 650 acres, setting the stage for creating an estate that would become an American legend. A plantation house constructed in 1797 stood elegantly atop a hill, its Creole cottage-style architecture a testament to the era's vernacular. Known originally as Richland or Laurel Grove, the estate seemed to watch over the land. What was initially believed to be a time of solitude for David Bradford, his family continued to expand. Son Judge David was born in 1796, daughter Elizabeth in 1797, and daughter Sarah, their first child born on the plantation, in 1798. The turn of the century marked a pivotal moment as Bradford and his family permanently settled at their new estate following a party from President John Adams in 1799. The lush landscape became a backdrop for new beginnings and the birth of their final child, daughter Octavia, their eighth child, in 1804. Bradford seemed to enjoy his final years as his family, plantation, and legacy flourished. Then on February 17, 1808, at age 54, David Bradford died at his home. The whereabouts of his final resting place, potentially within the lost Bradford family cemetery on the original plantation grounds, remains a mystery. After Bradford's passing, the plantation thrived under the stewardship of his widow, Eliza, and their children. But in 1811, the arrival of Clark Woodruff, a young man from Connecticut, brought a new dynamic to the region. Despite his initial aspirations to establish an academy in the area, Woodruff's destiny was intertwined with the plantation's future. His life took a martial turn when he served in the cavalry alongside Andrew Jackson during the War of 1812. Returning from battle, he pursued a legal career under the mentorship of none other than Judge David Bradford. However, Clark Woodruff fell in love with Judge David's younger sister, Sarah Matilda Bradford, and the pair were married on November 19, 1817, at the plantation. Under Woodruff's stewardship, the plantation flourished, expanding to include 650 acres of cotton and indigo. An 1820 census revealed a household of nine, a mix of the family, or free white people, and enslaved individuals. individuals, yet it appears to admit Eliza Bradford and one of the daughters, based on their age, hinting at inaccuracies or omissions in the records. This period also marked the beginning of enduring mysteries and scant historical records, obscuring the true character of the Bradfords and the Woodruffs and the dynamics within the plantation walls. We know they were enslaved individuals who lived in the primary house, but the relationship with the family and how they were treated is only speculated upon. Then, tragedy struck the family and plantation with a yellow fever pandemic, claiming Sarah Matilda around July 21, 1823, or possibly in 1824, and soon after, the young lives of James and Cornelia Gale in the summer of 1824. Despite these losses, Clark Woodruff and his remaining child, Mary Octavia, persevered with his mother-in-law, Eliza Bradford's support. By 1826, ownership of the plantation officially passed to Clark Woodruff, where he was reported to live with Eliza and Mary Octavia. By 1830, the plantation under Clark Woodruff's stewardship had again witnessed considerable growth, with the number of enslaved individuals rising to 32, a marked escalation from the 5 recorded a decade prior. As time marched forward, so did the fate of the Myrtles. Following Eliza Bradford's death in September 1831, the estate was entirely in the hands of Clark Woodruff, a transfer that likely brought its share of change and challenge. Then, on January 1, 1834, a significant transition unfolded. Clark Woodruff, whose tenure had seen the plantation's operation expand and the population of its enslaved workers grow, sold the property, including the enslaved individuals. Clark Woodruff moved to New Orleans, continued his career as a judge, and died in 1851 at the age of 60, seemingly of natural causes. The sale to Ruffin Gray Sterling and his wife, Mary Catherine Cobb, closed the chapter on the Bradford-Woodruff era and initiated a new epoch in the estate's legacy. Under new ownership, the land and the 1797 Creole cottage transformed into a structure that would become one of the most iconic homes in the United States. Ruffin and Mary married on July 20, 1830, and their first child, Sarah, was born in July 1833. The couple transformed their new estate without delay, with a vision of splendor and luxury. The Sterlings expanded the original structure, nearly doubling its footprint to encompass a resplendent 9 bays. This extension reached southward, enhancing the plantation's facade with a new double-door entrance. Each door boasted hand-painted stained glass that shimmered with motifs of the French cross, considered a safeguard against evil spirits. An astonishing 125 feet in length, the veranda unfurled across the front and curled around the southern end of the residence. It's crowned with an ornamental cast-iron railing, meticulously crafted to depict bunches of grapes, a nod to genteel refinement. Above, the roofline was redefined by adding 6 brick chimneys rising to meet the Louisiana skyline. Pedimented dormers, double-paned and stately, were interspersed with single-paned counterparts in a measured architectural rhythm, seamlessly integrated with the original structure. Upon crossing the threshold, one was greeted by the grandeur that continued to unfold within the home's 22 rooms. The entry hall, a promenade running the length of the house, is adorned with a faux bois finish, complemented by open pierce friezework molding that adds depth and texture. Dominating the space is a French baccarat crystal chandelier, an imposing piece weighing over 300 pounds. It hangs with quiet authority above the cantilevered staircase, which seems to float without support. The music room is nestled comfortably next to the lone first floor bedroom. To the right, a procession of large rooms flows gracefully from one to another. Parlors, a dining hall, and a game room. Each space is crowned with uniquely crafted plaster cornices and ceiling medallions made from a mixture of clay, Spanish moss, and cattle hair. Ascending to the second story, one found a private enclave of 5 bedrooms, each boasting the luxury of an ensuite bath. Beyond these, additional bedrooms lay across a common sitting area, accessible by a staircase that climbed from the rear loggia. Their floors were raised in keeping with the newer addition's elevation. The plantation grounds echoed the home's grandiosity. At the heart, a large pond, graced by a gazebo on a small island, offers a serene tableau. The primary residence is flanked by smaller outbuildings, connected by a sprawling brick courtyard, epitomizing the plantation's expansive reach. Embracing the botanical beauty of their surroundings, the Sterlings renamed their estate the Myrtles, inspired by the crepe myrtles that adorned the landscape. Post-renovation, the home stood as a paragon of antebellum architecture. It showcased a balanced, symmetrical front facade facade, punctuated by an even distribution of windows flanking a central door, which projected a sense of order and stateliness. The expansive, inviting porch, supported by robust columns, provided a shaded haven from the Louisiana heat and a venue for social repose. The sharply pitched roof, adorned with dormer windows, afforded additional attic space while facilitating light and ventilation. Louisiana's colonial past was echoed in the architectural details, such as the porch doors that facilitated airflow and granted easy access to outdoor living spaces. The home's raised foundation was a pragmatic response to the region's propensity for flooding and cooled the interior spaces. The ornate ironwork that adorned the railings and balcony was not merely decorative, but a public display of the family's wealth and standing. Each piece of custom ironwork was a testament to the craftsmanship and artistry of the time. As time went forward, the Sterling family grew with the birth of several more children: Mary in April 1845, Stephen in 1847, William in 1850, and their youngest, Henry, in 1853. However, in 1854, the family matriarch Mary was widowed by Ruffin's death at age 59, leaving her with a considerable estate to manage. Mary and her children, including Sarah, who in June 1852 married William Drew Winter, a northerner from Maine, would continue to steward the plantation. William Winter quickly ascended to the role of lawyer and manager for the plantation, solidifying his connection to the Myrtles through matrimony and vocation. Together, Sarah and William Winters grew their family, starting with the birth of Mary Sterling Winter in 1853, Sarah Sadie Bowman Winter in 1855, James Ernest in 1857, Kate Lyle in 1858, Ruffin Sterling in 1862, William DeLancey in 1865, and finally Francis Anderson in 1867. Tragedy first touched this growing family on January 29, 1861, when three-year-old Kate Lyle succumbed to typhoid fever. As personal grief befell the Winters, national turmoil ensued with the outbreak of the American Civil War in April 1861, a conflict that would rage until April 1865. The Myrtles was not spared from the war's ravages, its once lavish interior plundered by soldiers, leaving behind a mere shadow of its former affluence. Post-war, the Winters faced the devastation of their fortune, entangled in the worthless tendrils of Confederate currency. By March 1868, financial ruin loomed, and William Winter, besieged by debt, filed for bankruptcy. This financial collapse necessitated the sale of the plantation on April 15, 1868, to the U.S. Marshal, who in turn passed it to the New York Warehouse and Security Company. Fortune's wheel turned once more when, by April 1870, a small inheritance enabled Sarah Winter to reclaim the Myrtles plantation. Yet this resurgence of hope was fleeting. William Winter's life was cut short on the ill-fated evening of January 26, 1871. Answering a summons at the side door at 7 p.m., he was met with a barrage of gunfire. Six shots rang out, five found their mark in his chest, and a final, fatal blow struck his neck. He stumbled and fell on the porch, where he succumbed to his wounds. The assailant vanished into the night on horseback, leaving behind a mystery that would forever hang over the plantation, as the murder of William D. Winter has never been solved. In the wake of this atrocity, Sarah Winter, alongside her children and mother, persevered at the plantation, maintaining their home until her untimely passing in April 1878 at the age of 44, having never remarried. 2 years later, in August 1880, Mary Sterling, the family matriarch, died. Ownership then passed to her son and Sarah's brother, Stephen Sterling, who outmaneuvered his siblings to claim the property. But Stephen's tenure as owner of the Myrtles was brief and beset with fiscal trouble. It was rumored that he gambled away the remnants of the family's wealth, yet the burdensome debt and the cost of upholding such a property likely necessitated its sale. In March 1886, he conceded to his financial struggle and relinquished the Myrtles to Orrin D. Brooks, thus closing the chapter on the Sterling family's era at the plantation. However, Brooks' tenure as owner of the Myrtles plantation was brief, culminating in a sale in January 1889. The property passed through several hands until Harrison Milton Williams, a Civil War veteran and widower, became the property steward. In 1891, Williams, alongside his son from his first marriage and his new young bride, Fanny Linton Harrelson, provided a new era on the storied grounds. The plantation, under Williams' industrious care, thrived on cotton cultivation, earning him a reputation reputation for his diligent work ethic. Williams and Fanny welcome 6 children there. The Myrtles, resilient against the backdrop of the South's post-war recovery, remained a bustling home to multiple generations of the Williams family. But then a tragedy occurred when Fergus D. Harrelson, Fanny's father, passed away on the plantation on December 3, 1905. Harrison Williams followed shortly after on February 14, 1909, leaving his widow and children to run the plantation. After Harrison's passing, several acres of the estate were sold, yet Fanny and her children maintained their ties to the Myrtles for over a decade. During this era, the plantation emerged as a cultural beacon, hosting community gatherings and withstanding the invasions of trespassers who disrupted its tranquility. April 1926 marked a joyous union when Harrison Harry Williams Jr., the eldest of the Williams offspring, married Caro Eugene Davis, an esteemed figure in the community, and made the Myrtles their residence. However, about a year later, in February 1927, the family was cloaked in mourning once more when Harry perished in the Mississippi River amid a fierce storm. Fanny Williams, matriarch of the Myrtles, succumbed to ill health on January 11, 1935. At age 69, she passed away in the home she had long cherished. As the mid-20th century dawned, the William heirs parceled the land. Around this time, the first known ghost reports at the Myrtles were disclosed. According to a granddaughter of Harrison and Fanny Williams, family members used to talk about seeing the ghost of an older woman who wore a gray bonnet at the Myrtles. The Williams family often joked about seeing her. In December 1953, the Williams family bid farewell to their ancestral home, selling the estate to Marjorie Sawyer Munson, a wealthy Oklahoma widow who purchased just 10 acres of the original expanse. Marjorie, a widow since 1949, married Delore Joseph Michaud, a distinguished violinist, in 1955. Together, they nurtured the Myrtles, now a community haven, hosting concerts and famed patio dinners. Marjorie also professed encounters with the apparition of a woman garbed in a green beret. This is the apparent origin of the Myrtles plantation's most famous ghost, a woman named Chloe, a name that Marjorie used. But rather than an old woman, the spirit was now described as a young enslaved woman in a green hat. The tales of Chloe captured the imaginations of locals and visitors alike, with newspapers echoing the ghostly claims by 1971. However, as time went on, the story of Chloe began to evolve into something greatly embellished. With the growing legends, the Myrtles' architectural magnificence continued to captivate. The Myrtles changed hands again, and in the 1970s, it was restored under the ownership of Arlen Dees and Mr. and Mrs. Robert F. Ward. There had been a dispute over some antique mirrors believed to have been part of the sale. In November 1973, the estate's historical charm was showcased in an antique sale, offering storied contents to admirers of bygone splendor. By 1974, the Myrtles plantation was a well-established historic home. It became the epicenter for ghostly lore, captivating the public with many tales of slightly spectral inhabitants and witnessing unexplained phenomena. The ghost stories that now shroud the Myrtles in mystery were, until the 1970s, mere whispers passed down through the generations between families. While the estate had long been praised in print for its architectural grandeur and beauty, it soon became acclaimed for the accounts of ghostly encounters, spreading rapidly through publications. Around this time, James and Frances Kermeen Myers purchased the Myrtles with the vision of transforming the property into a bed and breakfast. The Myrtles came furnished with period antiques and a myriad of ghost stories, ripe for attracting those curious about history and hauntings. The spooky and tragic history of the Myrtles quickly became notable in ghostly and unexplained publications. However, these stories were often unverified narratives, rumors embellished over time, adding layers to the legend. The most famous of these legends is the tale of Chloe, a supposed vengeful spirit who has become an iconic figure in American ghost lore. Her story is set against the backdrop of the 1817 marriage of Sarah Matilda Bradford, daughter of the original owner, to Clark Woodruff. While Sarah Bradford Woodruff was expecting her third child, Mary Octavia, a fateful series of events began to unfold in the household. Clark Woodruff, a man known in the region for his integrity, but also his infidelity, 1790s, was said to have forced Chloe, an enslaved woman, into a sexual relationship. Fearful of being sent to the fields, a far worse fate, Chloe submitted. When Woodruff's attentions turned elsewhere, Chloe, desperate to regain favor, began to eavesdrop on the family's private affairs. Caught and punished by the removal of an ear, she resorted to wearing a green turban to conceal the mutilation, a detail that would become the hallmark of her ghostly apparition. The remainder of the ensuing tragedy at the Myrtles is steeped in ambiguity. Some believe Chloe concocted a plan to make the family ill, allowing her to nurse them back to health and restore her status within the household. Others attribute to her a darker intent, seeking revenge for her mistreatment. In the end, a birthday cake for one of the Woodruff children, laced with the toxic extract of oleander leaves, led to the deaths of Sarah Matilda and two of her children, while Clark Woodruff, who did not eat any of the cake, remained unharmed. In the aftermath, the other enslaved people, fearing retribution, hung Chloe from a tree, her body later cast into the river with stones to weigh her down. Woodruff, haunted by these events, sealed off the dining room where the poisonings occurred, and it remained unused for the remainder of his days. But these are simply unverified stories. As the 20th century progressed, the Myrtles witnessed a procession of owners, each contributing to ghostly tales. As this version of the story spread, those interested in the paranormal came looking for ghosts. Soon, authors and television crews came to the Myrtles, hoping to catch a ghost. The history of the home continued to change, this time including more murders and deaths. In addition to the deaths of Sarah Bradford Woodruff, her two children, and Chloe, it was alleged that as many as six other people had been killed in the house. One of them, Lewis Sterling, the oldest son of former owner Ruffin Gray Sterling, was alleged to have been stabbed to death in the house over a gambling debt. However, burial records indicate that he died in October 1854 from yellow fever. According to the growing legend, three Union soldiers were killed in the house after they broke in and attempted to loot the place. They were allegedly shot to death in the gentleman's parlor, leaving bloodstains on the floor that refused to be wiped away. There's a rumor that years later, after the Myrtles opened as an inn, a maid was mopping the floor when she reached the spot where the bloodstains were, and no matter how hard she tried, she couldn't clean it. Supposedly, the spot was the same size as a human body, and this was said to have been where one of the Union soldiers fell. The strange phenomenon was said to have lasted for a month and has not occurred since. The only problem with this story is that no soldiers were ever killed in the home. There are no records or evidence to say that there were, and in fact, surviving family members denied the story was true. If the ghostly incident did occur, something else must have caused it. Another murder allegedly occurred in 1927, when a caretaker at the house was supposedly killed during a robbery. Once again, no record exists of this incident. The only event close to this, which many have spawned as the story, occurred when Fanny Williams' brother, Eddie Harrelson, lived in a small house on the property. He did die during a robbery, but this did not occur in the main house, as the story states. The only verifiable murder to occur at the Myrtles was that of William Drew Winter, and it differs wildly from the legends told in media publications. In the legend, William was shot and then, mortally wounded, staggered back into the house, passed through the gentlemen's and the ladies' parlors, and onto the staircase that rises from the central hallway. He managed to climb just high enough to die in his wife's arms on the 17th step. It has since been claimed that ghostly footsteps have been heard coming into the house, walking to the stairs, and then climbing to the 17th step, where they, of course, come to an end. But now we know the truth behind many of these stories. Many of the ghostly sightings of Chloe came from past owners, like Marjorie, and later Frances Myers, who claimed she witnessed a full-bodied apparition of Chloe holding a candle in 1987. Then, in 1992, new owners John and Tita Moss purchased the Myrtles. They took a photo for insurance purposes that appeared to capture something shocking. The photo propelled the Myrtles into a haven of paranormal activity, and it was sent worldwide. Between the house and another smaller building, a dark-skinned figure with what appears to be a turban on the head can be seen. It was stated the figure was not seen when the property owners took the photo. Immediately, this was believed to be the spirit of Chloe, captured on film. In addition to ghostly apparitions, there is an antique mirror in the downstairs grand hallway just outside the dining room. Many visitors have claimed to have witnessed the spirits of small children in the mirror. The glass on the mirror is said to have been replated several times, but a smudge that appears to be a handprint always reappears in the same spot. Claims of paranormal activity, primarily young children and a woman's spirit in the green turban, are commonly experienced. Heavy footsteps echo throughout the home, like boots from a long-ago era on a hardwood floor. To this day, visitors, guests, and owners continue to experience unexplained phenomenon. Today, a multi-generational family again operates the property. John and Tita's son and daughter-in-law continue to operate the Myrtles Plantation as a bed and breakfast. They also offer daily ghost tours day and night, and have since opened a small restaurant and gift shop on the property. In August 2014, a fire broke out in a historic outbuilding that housed the general store. The fire was just 10 feet from the main home, causing damage to an extension from 2008, but the original part of the home was undamaged. The Myrtles today claims to have 12 ghosts, with several murders occurring on the premises. However, much of the truth was greatly embellished by the 1970s and continues to be elaborated upon and dramatized today. But the era of most mystery is the time surrounding Clark Woodruff and his family. Historical accounts indicate Clark and Sarah Woodruff had three children, James, Cornelia Gale, and Mary Octavia. However, there are questions surrounding the births and deaths of the two older children, and perhaps Sarah Matilda Bradford's life was veiled in its own secrecy. While we don't have the exact dates of her first two children's births, based on known historical data, son James's birth likely occurred in 1814, and daughter Cornelia Gale's birth likely occurred in 1816. These two children, often credited as Clark Woodruff's children, preceded their union and possibly before they ever met. Only the birth of their daughter Mary Octavia on October 3, 1818, nearly a year after their marriage, clarified their lineage. It is widely believed that Sarah Bradford Woodruff and her two children died as a result of a yellow fever pandemic and were not murdered, as suggested. In the early 19th century, mortality rates in succumbing to diseases or illnesses were high, and there was a pandemic around this time, making this the most plausible death. We don't know the details surrounding these two children, which makes understanding the family's dynamic nearly impossible. Historical data also provides only a slight glimpse into the early history of the plantation and leaves further questions. In 1820, the plantation census records indicate two young enslaved women living there in their childbearing years. The next decade would show the demographics of the enslaved on the estate paint a picture of a young and growing population. Seven males and one female under the age of 10, three males in their teens to early 20s, and a distribution across other age brackets up to 99 years. The 1830 census implies the arrival of at least eight enslaved children during the 1820s. Given the increase in children, this raises the possibility that new generations were born on the plantation, potentially fathered by Woodruff himself. The authentic fabric of the plantation's past is woven into this intricate and delicate tapestry of personal and private histories and untold stories. While direct evidence is not available for the Woodruffs, such situations were not uncommon in the antebellum South, with the inherent power dynamics often leading to the exploitation of enslaved women by their owners. The true nature of these relationships is complicated to ascertain and remains a delicate and complex aspect of America's historical landscape. What we do know is that during Clark Woodruff's tenure, there were at least two enslaved women of childbearing age. Was one of them the woman we now know as Chloe? If that's not her real name, who was she? And is there any truth in her story? We may never know the answer to any of these questions. This estate also recalls a time when extended families all lived together, and there were likely always many children running around the property. Without DNA testing, the lineage would be complicated to discern. We also have no way of knowing exactly the number of family members, extended or otherwise, that could have passed away at the estate, most likely from illness or old age. The only confirmed murder to occur at the Myrtles was that of William Winters, and he did not die on the 17th step in the arms of his sweetheart. He died on the side porch after being mortally wounded nearly instantly. What is certain is that the Myrtles plantation is haunted. Over time, there have been too many odd occurrences, witnesses to unexplained events, similarities in reports and accounts between strangers, and paranormal evidence captured on film, which continues today. Is that what makes this historic home so fascinating? The possibility of seeing or interacting with the past seemingly becomes real. If you're interested in learning more about the Myrtles Plantation, or brave enough to stay the night, you can learn more at themyrtles.com. For those who have visited the Myrtles Plantation, what was your experience? Do you agree that it's America's most haunted house, or is it a haunted house with an excellent marketing campaign and truth to something more terrible in a time that has scarred America's past than we can imagine? Thank you for listening to Nightmare Houses. For more information, including photos and references, please visit www.nightmarehouses.com. Until next time, goodbye.